Welcome to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. My name is Fregal Byrne. Every week I speak to leading sustainability thinkers and practitioners, scientists, economists, NGOs, business leaders and investors. We discuss the sustainability imperative, the key challenges, the latest thinking, and what's working in sustainability, resilience and regeneration. I'm very pleased today to welcome Eva Gladick to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. Eva is the founder and CEO of Metabolic, a consulting and venture-building company that uses systems thinking to tackle critical sustainability challenges. Eva originally trained as a molecular biologist and industrial ecologist. She's advised over 300 companies and industry leaders and developed broadly adapted methodologies for system thinking, the circular economy, and sustainable design. Thank you very much, Eva, for joining me today on the Sustainability Agenda podcast.
Great. Very happy to be here. Thanks.
Excellent. So I'd like to talk to you about the work that you do at Metabolic. I'd like to find out more about that work. And maybe just to begin, if you're able to tell us a little bit about your background and what Metabolic does.
Yeah, absolutely. So my personal background is that I started my career as a molecular biologist. I started working in laboratories quite early on in my life and was really passionate about becoming a geneticist. Went to university to study that and get a degree in it. And in that process, realized that I was becoming hyper-specialized in a very small subset of what was going on in the world, and that all of these bigger societal issues were kind of out of reach from my bench in the laboratory. And I then switched gears to get a degree in something called industrial ecology, which is the science of sustainability. And we use different techniques like material flow analysis, life cycle assessment, systems dynamics modeling to understand the human world in relation to the environment and how these two different systems affect one another. And in principle, there's a lot of use of biological metaphors to really understand how can we bring the human economy in line with to have it have a healthy metabolism, to have it process resources and energy in a way that continues to cycle as it does in the natural world. And so Metabolic, continuing with that biological metaphor for human systems, we're really looking at the health of the metabolism of the economy and of our cities and of our industries, and trying to bring them in line with the limits of the planet, so within the planetary boundaries and the safe operating space. In lots of ways, Metabolic is an applied industrial ecology firm. That's a lot of what we do. But since most people don't understand what an industrial ecology is, we often explain our activities by saying that we have a consulting arm, we have a think tank, and we have a venture building arm. So three distinct entities operating under the Metabolic brand that are all working toward our one mission, which is to transition the global economy to a fundamentally sustainable state, and to do that as quickly as possible using a kind of systems approach to identify the greatest areas of leverage.
Right. Really important work. I normally start at the outset to ask interviewees what's on their mind right now. Well, we're in the middle of this lockdown and in very challenging circumstances. Maybe if you could tell me a little bit about what's on your mind, and maybe, I guess, in the run-up to this as well. I mean, you've been working in this area of sustainability for many years, and just at that kind of juncture that of time.
Yeah, I mean, of course, I'm pretty sure this is on everyone's mind, but I am continuously thinking about the current surreal situation we find ourselves in with this whole pandemic, and really linking that to the work that we do, and really thinking of the lessons that we've drawn from years of these different projects to understand what resilient systems look like, what resilient human systems and economic systems look like, and trying to think of, okay, well, what are the best pathways that we could use to navigate from this this kind of rupture that we've experienced in the normal flow of daily life to a new state? And I think there are ways to use this situation to our advantage, because it has awoken people to the fact that large scale change is possible, even overnight, that we are really our own, you know, the only thing that is preventing us from taking dramatic actions is ourselves. So it has created an opening for perhaps more radical pathways. You know, seeing Spain announcing that they're going to be implementing universal basic income and that is their long-term plan. That's something that would have been quite unthinkable previously, but we've been thrust into a series of very large-scale experiments. So I think that's one of the elements of silver lining. But of course, a lot of it is just tragic and quite challenging to deal with on both a kind of personal and organizational level, as well as anticipating what might happen to the economy at large as we progress through this.
Yes, yes, very interesting. Clearly, as you say, it's first and foremost an enormous human tragedy that's still unfolding. But as you say, looking forward as well, it's important to start thinking about that, particularly as so much is changing at the moment. Just wondering, in terms of looking at what has happened from the lens of resilience, I suppose, what would have been your diagnosis as to, I guess, I mean, I know you operate, you do a lot of work at city level and corporate level, but presumably also have a vision, a view of national economics, which is, you know, tied in with the global economics as well. So I guess looking at through the lens of resilience, how you would have diagnosed, maybe just at a very a little bit of an overview, where we were as an economy, as a global economy, and I guess how that diagnosis has come true, or, you know, the degree to which where we are today reflects some ideas about resilience.
Yeah, so I've obviously been thinking about this a lot, and I feel like there are a few ways in which we've clearly exposed some of the cracks in the system and shown how it's not resilient when it comes to the global economy, some pretty drastically. So for one thing, we've obviously revealed the fragility of the way we've organized our supply chains. There's been a lot of discussion about this online. If you've ever looked at network diagrams showing just theoretical networks that can either be organized as hubs and spokes, or distributed networks with multiple hubs, or mesh networks, they have different levels of resilience to impacts. And so we have been very lulled into a kind of sense of security with everything humming along so well for so many decades, that we've actually started to really centralize certain types of production, certain types of knowledge, certain resource flows. So we have gotten to a kind of less resilient supply chain network that has been very hard hit by the crisis. So there were reports of around 70% of companies experiencing some kind of supply chain disruption. Of course, there were lots of discussions around the disruption in the supply of pharmaceuticals and medical equipment, concerns about electronics and certain types of goods that are manufactured in particular parts of the world running out. So that's kind of one indication that we don't have robust, self-sufficient communities or regional supply chains that cover all the bases. And that's something that I think there is going to be a rebound on moving forward, looking to create more kind of local resilience. And this isn't about, you know, closing off economies or necessarily deglobalizing. It's more really about thinking about the different types of potential disruptions that could take place and how to build a more resilient supply network. And when it comes to the circular economy, it's also highly beneficial because we need to move toward a situation where we actually have, let's say, urban centers not just serving as consumers, as these kind of resource drains, drawing materials from the hinterlands and from other parts of the world, but rather also figuring out how to repurpose those materials in closed cycles within the kind of peri-urban area of those cities and those regions, because it doesn't make sense to continuously transport in and out all of this material. And it actually creates much more resilient hubs and communities with more diverse economic practices and activities. So there is a kind of dual pathway there. about creating more resilience to shocks, as well as increasing the potential of a local circular economy. So that's one dimension that has revealed, you know, that has been revealed in this whole situation. There are several others. One of them has to do with the massive amount of inequality that we know has been plaguing the entire world for decades, and has been only getting more severe, with the richest of the rich having vast amounts of financial resources, and then more and more of the people at the bottom of the pyramid. Well, that pyramid is getting bigger with a broader base, and people have less and less money. Now that becomes everyone's problem once the situation, if you have a situation like this, the one we're facing now, where lots of different sectors of the economy have shut down, many people are suddenly out of work, and none of them had financial buffering capacity to really survive for a longer period of time. So we're seeing these record amounts of unemployment and people basically falling out of the bottom of the system. And in the global south, of course, there have been projections that this is going to set back improvements in reductions in poverty by around 30 years. So really drastic shifts. And this has to fundamentally do with the unequal distribution of wealth and the kind of concentration of buffering capacity on one side of the population, whereas the vast majority of people don't have ways to get through any kind of crisis. And ultimately, that's not good for anyone, not for the wealthy people either. So that's another dimension of resilience, and something that we've seen failing in this current situation.
Yes, very interesting. The I probably should have asked you how you look at. I know there are many ways probably of framing or parsing it, but how you look at resilience, what it actually means.
Yeah, so I mean, of course, like the kind of general definition of, or like the very common definition of resilience has to do with the ability of a system to withstand shocks and to maintain its functioning. Now, that's not necessarily something that we always want, because some of the systems that we are really problematic, and we don't actually want them to maintain their current levels of functioning. So I think it's really about identifying the kind of parameters and characteristics of society that we wish to maintain and keep, and ensuring that those qualities can survive any kind of crisis or change. So it has to do with creating adaptability and self-learning mechanisms, and indeed buffering capacity, strong communities, and having kind of fundamental mechanisms for self-replicating solutions and distributing knowledge and allowing people to kind of adaptively grow out of crises.
That's very interesting that what you say, because clearly, you know, if you look at the state of the world today, you would say that maybe the particular form of economics that we have today has not served us well, and shouldn't really be, wouldn't be helpful as a way forward, things need to fundamentally change. And I'm just wondering, does your work, have you looked at, because this, I guess it overlaps with an area of collapse as well, because some things have to collapse. How do you, have you in your work come across this kind of, as you say, adaptive change, where a system, parts of the system have to collapse or die or be radically transformed, while, you know, you want new elements to come into the system as well? I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I think it's kind of inevitable that if you want to radically transform a system, that parts of it will probably have to collapse, because we all know that it's very difficult to get rid of the existing status quo. And this is one of the things that, I've been working on a book for quite some time, and hoping to to put some more priority on that in the coming year. But it's really about envisioning the type of economic system that we actually need in order to support a sustainable circular economy, a sustainable vision of a future, as well as well-being and the potential for self-actualization for all people. Because I do fundamentally believe that the current economic system is not designed for that. It's actually designed in such a way that it prevents many of those outcomes from occurring. And even if you envision this kind of pathway, this different kind of economic model, getting there from here is very challenging because there are so many entrenched there's so much lock-in. So that's also why I said that, you know, having some element of collapse can be seen as an opportunity to insert new pathways and to at least create mindset changes that open up certain pathways for people. So I suppose, yes, you can say collapse is not always bad, but ideally, in order to avoid as much suffering as possible, it needs to be a controlled form of collapse or something that's, you know, like you can blow up a building callously and without paying attention to its architectural form, and it can create a lot of damage. Or you can be one of these demolition experts that are able to figure out how to get it to collapse directly on top of its footprint without creating any damage outside of its zone. So I think there are different ways to approach collapse as well.
Yes, yeah, it's a very interesting area and happening as we speak, I suppose. A lot of your work has focused on, urban areas and cities and so forth. Can you talk a little bit about, what are some of the lessons that you've learned about resilience, about, you know, creating more resilient cities, shall we say, and how that might be helpful in us thinking about ways going forward of, creating more resilient economic systems?
Yeah, sure. For me, a lot of the kind of discussion around resilience comes down to some fairly simple things. Humans are fundamentally quite straightforward creatures, I think. You know, for most people, in order to feel satisfied with their lives, they want access to a community of people that they respect and that respects them, and where they feel accepted and safe, and where they can learn and experience things, and to be able to spend most of their time in meaningful ways. So this is what people generally need in order to be happy. And I feel like if you are able to create the environment within cities or rural contexts, whatever it may be, where you foster the development of strong community units that have certain levels of autonomy, as in certain governance rights of their own, that are linked up to larger units of multiple communities that have certain other governance rights, and that within these communities you have good levels of exchange of resources, of time, that people can provide each other with support services in a kind of non-transactional way, then you start to create a foundation of a really resilient city. You also need, of course, a certain level of diversity. We need, if you have monocultures tend to be not resilient in general. You can see that with, you know, imagine a field of a single type of crop, and a pest appears that likes that crop, and all of a sudden it's all gone. When you have polycultures, there's more ability for different parts of the system to compensate for one another, et cetera. And this is absolutely true in cities. So you need strong communities, you need diversity, you need good decentralization of different governance principles, and giving people the feeling that they are in charge of their own destinies and authorities. And, you know, I'm talking a lot about the human level of things, because that's really where the foundations are. A lot of our work, of course, focuses on environmental impacts in the kind of biophysical sphere, the design of buildings, the design of neighborhoods, et cetera. But it rests on that foundation of strong communities. And then you're able to build the kind of physical infrastructure that both supports those communities as well as creates fundamental physical resilience to, you know, climate issues, weather issues, that reduces the, that actually increases linkages by creating more porous, walkable environments, et cetera, et cetera.
Very interesting. And how do corporates interface with these when you look at it at this level?
How do corporates interface with cities, or how do they?
Yeah, when you're talking about this resilience that grows from communities and so forth, in your experience, corporations are profit maximizing entities by and large. You work with corporations too, I guess, from the circular economy perspective. But what role do they play in collaborating or being part of or interfacing with these kind of sustainable, resilient communities?
Well, they can and should play a very important role. It depends. You know, like if corporations are part of the system, then they can and should play an important role. But the nature of corporations is also something that has to fundamentally change, because they are indeed designed to maximize profit at all costs for the most part, even though they're full of really good people who have other objectives and mostly are very good-hearted. Sometimes it's just not possible within the kind of framework of the corporation and what it allows one to do, to take actions in that direction. But I do think that, so one of the things that we've seen, of course, we do indeed work with lots of corporations. Most of the work that we do with companies is much less visible because a lot of it is indeed under NDA, or we just can't share it. And corporations tend to have, very expansive supply chains that are often both horizontally and vertically integrated, where they gain control over resources around the world. They standardize the design of certain products and the conversion of those resources into these products. And we get a lot of value out of that, certainly. A lot of people love being able to order a Starbucks latte anywhere in the world, and it's always the same. And they can rely on that quality, and they trust the fact that it's not going to poison them. So there's a lot of value that people get from it. But it also has a consequence of funneling away those resources that could be used by local communities to produce local goods with completely different ingredients or outputs, or it basically tamps down the creativity of the human workforce in a way, because most people are then brought into producing these standardized products instead of producing their own things and gaining the profit from producing their own things or creating local economies. So I think one of the pathways forward that we're also exploring with some of our corporate partners and encouraging them to move in this direction is to actually reverse some aspects of this centralization and this standardization, and instead tap into the power of communities and basically support the development of stronger communities, support farmer cooperatives, support the development of new products through kind of like brand partnerships with local people, build capacity in these areas, and then have, instead of having one product that's available everywhere, have like many different products around the world that are customized based on the local, agricultural crops available and other resources, and that are produced by local groups. So that is one pathway that you could take with corporations and them encouraging and creating resilience. Of course, it's much more complicated than that. And it's still, I'm not saying necessarily that this is the future that we want, but it's a pathway, let's say, that is like a transition from having corporate structures that dominate all resource flows to a model where we move toward more local hubs and resilience and decentralization and tapping into something like what the economies of pre-corporate eras looked like.
Yes. Yeah. Very interesting. Some big questions here and trying to cover a lot of ground here. But you mentioned this work that you're doing with corporations and so forth. In your experience, what are a few of the, necessary conditions for this work to succeed? There are obviously many different forces in play when you come to circular type economics. You've got, you know, government regulations, you've got consumers, you've got stakeholders, you've got corporate culture. And I guess to some degree, you've got different kinds of corporations now, or with B Corps and things like that. But I'm just wondering from your experience, presumably, you see some projects just do better. Other projects, you know, you spend a lot of time, have a lot of insights and so forth. But actually, how much of that's translated into action can be sometimes a challenge or another question. Are there a few elements that you think that are propitious for change on this front?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the most important preconditions of successful corporate transformation towards sustainability is definitely buy-in and commitment from upper management. And this is something that we just see consistently. So some of the projects that we're doing with large companies are indeed with directly with CEOs and with C-level and board level parties. And others are slightly lower down the management chain. And both types of engagement can be quite successful in resulting in actual implementation. But if we're working with kind of middle management and there isn't the kind of direct drive and mandate from the CEO saying, yes, prioritize sustainability, then you see that things fall flat consistently. So, for example, I was recently having a conversation with a packaging department of a large corporate. And we were talking about how they needed to, with just a few changes to their packaging design, they could make it fully recycled and recyclable and within current infrastructure. And therefore, it would be circular in that sense. And they were, and so we were asking them, well, you know, are these changes that we're talking about, is this technically possible? Can you do this? And they said, yeah, this is no problem. These are actually very easy changes to make. We could definitely do this. And then we asked, well, why haven't you? And they said, well, because these aren't part of our mandate. We've never been told to prioritize these elements or these outcomes. And we've not been asked to make this this packaging circular or recyclable or recycled. It's just not been part of the objective. And I think that exists, that kind of situation exists in so many organizations where it's so easy to make fundamental changes to products and packaging and all sorts of other things that drastically reduce footprint, but it's just not done. So that's one piece, which is the kind of top-down buy-in. But the biggest stumbling block, and this isn't news, is that often sustainable choices do not optimize for profit. Sometimes they do. There's this Venn diagram of where you have, sustainable solutions and product designs, and then basically things that optimize for profit. And sometimes you have projects in between in that kind of intersection that really work on both objectives. But for the most part, the kind of sustainable choices lead to long-term profit maximization and long-term resilience and multiple different types of value that they produce, from preserving natural capital to preserving natural health to all sorts of things that we don't calculate and don't account for. And they don't stack up very well against exploitative, destructive practices and product design choices that maximize for short-term profit, which is the only metric that that is calculated by many of these organizations. And that's something that is still the fundamental stumbling block.
Yes, yes. Now, at the heart of your work, I get the impression the systems thinking, systems approach seems to be everywhere. Can you talk a little bit about that? And also in terms of Yeah, where do we see good examples of systems thinking, and how would a we talk about cities or corporates incorporate more systems type thinking? Firstly, what would be the benefits of that? And secondly, are you optimistic, or how do we move towards a more systems based thinking approach?
Yeah, great question. So, systems thinking is in many ways very straightforward. It's the recognition that everything is connected, and that if you take an action, there isn't just one immediate reaction, but a whole cascade, a whole ripple effect of things that knock on from that one action. And in the kind of model of the world that most of us have been trained in through school, we take a very reductionist, we're taught a very reductionist approach, where A leads to B, and that's it, and you don't look outside that that scope. But the problem, there are many problems that result from this kind of reductionist view rather than a systems view. And sometimes I explain this by using a simple metaphors of the Rubik's Cube. So if you have a Rubik's Cube and you're trying to solve it, and you're trying to, and you approach it from a reductionist viewpoint, you'll look at one of the squares that you want to move to a particular location, and then you'll take the actions needed to twist the cube so that it moves to that spot. Now, of course, it's a complex puzzle that's based on an algorithm, basically, if you want to solve it. And so if you twist it just to move that one square to the location you want it to go, it's going to scramble the rest of the cube. So you'll just keep messing it up over and over again. So you really need to understand the system of the cube, the algorithm that's behind the solution, to be able to actually crack the puzzle. So in real life, what this looks like is that people make really kind of reductionist choices by narrowing down the scope of their focus. And they say, okay, well, another common example that I use is around light bulbs. So we know that the incandescent light bulb is quite energy intensive. And so if you give a designer the challenge of making a different kind of lighting solution that uses less energy, they might produce something like the CFL or the mercury lamp, as it's also known. So one of the challenges of that is that you can solve for an energy problem. So the CFL is much more energy efficient, but you can create a new problem at the same time. So even though they don't have as much mercury in them today as they used to, they are known as mercury lamps because they contain mercury. And mercury is a neurotoxin that we've been trying to get out of our environment for a long time. And now we're creating a product that is basically distributing this neurotoxin throughout many people's homes. And of course now CFLs have mostly been superseded by LEDs, but they have other challenges associated with them as well. And they're basically electronics, so we need to figure out how to get those complex, scarce materials back. So we have to have this continuous understanding of trade-offs and of what we call burden shifting. So solving for one problem while creating a new one. And if we don't have the systems perspective when looking at the challenges that we're trying to tackle, we are going to continuously create these burden shifting accidents, and we're not actually going to move toward the goal that we want to go into. So there's a number of different strategies that you can use to think more systemically and to avoid these different pitfalls, of which there are many more. I have several lectures that I give on this topic. And one of them is to use holistic sets of indicators when you're trying to track progress. So never, for example, just focus on carbon emissions. Like a single indicator measure for tracking progress towards sustainability is always going to be problematic, because it always creates the space and opportunity for these burden shifting issues to occur. So you fix your carbon problem, but suddenly there are more children dying in Africa, and you didn't pay attention because it was out of your scope of focus. So that's one very important element in terms of using systems thinking. Another kind of basic thing that we always do is we we map out the system and try to understand it in as much detail as possible before we start to mess with it. So if you're trying to optimize a supply chain or a product or a neighborhood or a whole city, we always start our work by doing a systems analysis and trying to understand both the physical flows of resources, but also the flows of people and stakeholders and money, and really trying to see how they relate to one another and what the kind of structure of that system is and why it's resulting in certain impacts that you want to get rid of. And once you know what that looks like, it starts to become very straightforward to figure out how to transform it. You also need a really clear vision of what you want that system to look like in the end state once you've transformed it. So you have your current state where you're starting from. It's kind of like plotting a route on Google Maps. Like, you need to know where you're starting from and where you're going to before you can draw a route between them. So there's lots of different techniques, and we teach them also to both cities and companies.
Oh, very interesting. Very interesting. And I guess there are, just if you extrapolate or take, if you look at, let's say, the Paris Accords and so forth, if you look at really stepping out at a very, very, very global level, you might have a sense of where you want to go by some kind of measures and so forth, but mapping that system is almost impossible. So I suppose there are some heuristics or ways of thinking about moving a system towards a direction maybe and then leverage points along the way?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's also one of the big challenges or tricks in working using systems thinking, is that the actual system, if you wanted to map out let's say you took the world as the system and you wanted to map out that system in perfect detail, well, you would need another Earth. That would be the map. So that's obviously not possible. So a lot of the art in it is to figure out how to reduce it in complexity so that you're maintaining the most important relationships and covering basically 80% of what's important in some way. So we have different tricks for doing that, for simplifying things down.
Yes, very interesting. So I just wanted to come back to the circular economy for a moment and get a sense. How do you dimensionalize the potential of something like the circular economy, and where are we on the journey? Another big question, and I guess it varies very much by sector and so forth. But really, how much potential do you think there is here in really moving towards a sustainable world?
I think there's a few things that we need to achieve. So the way that we've been conceptualizing this with Metabolic is that there's this bigger overarching transition of moving to a sustainable world that we want to achieve, planet within planetary boundaries. And we've divided into six sub transitions that we're trying to measure and push forward. And one of them is the agri-food and land use transition. One is the transition in cities and regions, so our habitat and how we live. And one of them is indeed the kind of industry and products and services transition. In terms of the circular economy, I genuinely believe that we need to move toward a world where all of our resources are managed in a circular way. The potential for this, I mean, there are various studies that have estimated it, linking it to climate change. So there's a study that I've seen that estimates between 60 to 70% carbon emissions reduction by moving to a circular economy, basically stating that it's also one of the prerequisites for achieving the Paris ambitions. Work that we've done has also shown that we simply don't have enough critical metals of different types for producing all the solar panels and wind turbines and electric vehicle batteries that we're going to need. If we don't have a circular model, we actually really need to figure out how to recover these materials back into the system. So the potential is huge. It's also very logical to try to design a system modeled more after the natural flow of resources, where no wastes are structurally created, at least not problematically. And I think we can definitely do it. It's just a matter of having that be a directive and a mandate. Now, if you said, okay, from a certain date in the future, let's say from 2025, no products can be put on the market that are not designed according to circular principles. And what does that mean? That means that they have to be fully disassemblable and recyclable at high value, and within infrastructure that exists. And you just said that that's now a rule. Well, then we would be very rapidly on our way toward a circular economy. It's quite possible. And it harkens back to that conversation that I described with these packaging designers for this large corporate, who were actually very capable of doing this, but weren't able to implement these solutions without the kind of mandate and directive. So one of the things that we're doing is we have this circular product design bootcamp, and we're working with some organizations to take a product and re-envision it from scratch, imagining that it was fully circular. And so we've done this quite successfully with a few organizations, and I've been quite impressed with the results, but I just wish we could accelerate that and make that kind of way of thinking and approach available to more companies.
Yes. I have one final question, but just before that, if that's okay, if we're okay for time, I'm just wondering how far are we on our journey? If you're a clear-eyed assessment of, you know, a very difficult, I know, let's say global industry, but, you know, is there some way you'd, you know, represent where we are in the journey towards a circular economy or, you know,
Very, very early on in the journey. So, I mean, like, I think if you look at...
We left the train station.
Yeah, at least we're at the train station, but I think we're just at the train station. So I think that people are just coming into awareness about what this is, what the potential could be. But if you look at the actual performance metrics, it's most of the things that you still, if you go to a shop, most of the things that you buy will not be packaged in recyclable packaging. Most of the products are designed for, that have really scarce and valuable materials. They're not designed for material recovery or reuse. And it's just pretty straightforward. Yeah, buildings, same thing. Like,
Yes. Amsterdam. I know you've been doing work in Amsterdam, and I know also, and I spoke to Kate Raworth before, who's they now published the donut for Amsterdam.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, mindful of the time, but what lessons are there? Are there a few lessons in terms of how Amsterdam is approaching, I guess, a sustainable city?
So as a resident of Amsterdam, a big fan of Kate's as well, in general, I'm quite impressed with what Amsterdam does. I'm on the sustainability board of the city, and also on the International Economic Board. So I do get quite a kind of upfront look at what's going on. And I've been really pleased to see that Amsterdam has decided that the donut approach is going to be the economic pathway out of COVID. And that's something that they're doubling down on and committing to, rather than saying, oh no, we have to just go back to, you know, conventional means of making profit and just getting things set up. They're really looking at it as an interesting transition moment. I think Amsterdam has a good way of engaging its citizens. It's actually relatively easy as a citizen to comment on and get involved in various projects. They have high levels of ambition. Of course, the ambition can always be higher, but I think they're really pushing themselves, especially with this new plan and objectives to become fully circular and carbon neutral. So they're really taking it very seriously. I don't know whether I can say more about it, but I'm happy to comment in more detail.
Great. And what's next for you, Eva, in terms of metabolic or any particular projects or direction that you're looking at right now?
We have a lot of really exciting things happening within metabolic. As I mentioned in the beginning of the chat, metabolic started out really as one organization, but there was always this idea of it becoming more of an ecosystem of organizations, because we need different approaches to tackle the big challenge that we're facing, and that can't really comfortably be held within one entity. So over the years, we always wanted to set up a venture building arm, and we only just now formally set that up because we first set ourselves the challenge of actually building three ventures successfully. And now that we've done that and we've set up the venture building arm, I think we can have like a whole new way of engaging with the world by creating also more disruptive vehicles for the transition. We have a very exciting project, an e-commerce platform that we're collaborating with someone on that I think it will be a really big step in the sustainability space. And that's going to launch sometime next year. So there's a lot of things, but we, I think in terms of our philosophy and our vision around sustainability, we're continuously sharpening that. And I personally really hope that I will finally have time to write that book this year, which becomes more realistic actually with this whole crisis. But we'll see. Yeah, so there's a lot ahead.
Great, great. Well, I wish you all the best with that, Eva, and with your book. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Virgil.
Thank you for listening to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. I hope you found it interesting. It would be great if you could leave a review and share the podcast on social media. You can sign up at iTunes to make sure you don't miss any future episodes.